Look to Windward. Cassette 4.
I am sure it will go wonderfully well. When does Hub intend to announce the concert?
Very soon now, Zilla said, sounding defensive. It was one of the reasons I came over here. I thought I might be besieged if I stayed home.
Kabe nodded slowly. I am glad to be of service, and I cannot wait to hear the piece.
Thank you. I'm pleased with it, but I can't help feeling complicit with Hub's ghoulishness.
I wouldn't call it ghoulish. Old soldiers are rarely so. Depressed, disturbed, and morbid sometimes, but not ghoulish. That is a civilian preoccupation.
Hub isn't a civilian, Zilla asked. Hub might be depressed and disturbed. Is this something else they didn't tell me about?
Masak Hub has never been either depressed or disturbed, to my knowledge, Kabe said. However, it was once the mind of a war-adapted general systems vehicle, and it was there at the Twin Novi battle at the end of the war, and suffered near total destruction at the hands of an Ideran battle fleet.
Not quite total.
Not quite.
They don't believe in the captain going down with the ship, then.
I understand that being last to abandon it is considered sufficient. But do you see, Masak mourns and honors those it lost, those who died, and seeks to atone for whatever part it played in the war.
Zilla shook his head. The scummer might have told me some of this, he muttered. Kabe pondered the wisdom of remarking that Zilla might have discovered all of this easily enough himself, had he been so inclined, but decided against it. Zilla tapped his pipe out. Well, let us hope it does not suffer from despair. Drone E.H. Tersono is here, the house announced.
Oh, good.
About time.
Invite it in.
The drone floated in through the balcony window, sunlight dappling its rosy porcelain skin and blue lumenstone frame.
I noticed the window was open. Hope you don't mind.
Not at all.
Eavesdropping outside, were we? Zilla asked.
The drone settled delicately on a chair.
My dear Zilla, certainly not. Why? Were you talking about me?
No.
So, Tersono, Kabe said, it is very kind of you to visit. I understand we owe the honor to further news of our envoy.
Yes. I have learned the identity of the emissary being sent to us by Chell, the drone said. His full name is, and I quote, called to arms from Given, Major Tabilo Quillen IV, Autumn 47th of Eiterawine, Griefling, Sherecht Order.
Good heavens, Kabe said, looking at Zilla. Your full names are even longer than the cultures.
Yes. An endearing trait, isn't it? Zilla said. He looked into his pipe, brows puckered.
So, our emissary is a warlord priest, a rich broker boy from one of the sovereign families who's found a taste for soldiering, or been shunted into it to keep him out of the way, and then found faith, or found it politic to find it. Parents traditionalists, and he's a widower, probably.
You know him? Kabe asked.
Actually, I do. From a long time ago. We were at infant school together. We were friends, I suppose, though not particularly close. We lost touch after that. Haven't heard of him since.
Zilla inspected his pipe and seemed to be contemplating lighting it again. Instead, he replaced it in his waistcoat pocket.
Even if we weren't once acquainted, though, the rest of the name rigmarole tells you mostly what you need to know.
He snorted.
Culture full names act as addresses. Ours act as potted histories. And, of course, they tell you whether you should bow or be bowed to. Our Major Quillen will certainly expect to be bowed to.
You may be doing him a disservice, Tersono said.
I have a full biography you might be interested in.
Well, I'm not, Zilla said emphatically, turning away to look at a painting hanging on one wall. It showed long-ago Homomdans riding enormous tusked creatures, waving flags and spears, and looking heroic in a hectic sort of way.
I'd like to look at it later, Kabe said.
Certainly.
So that's what, 23, 24 days till he gets here?
How about that? Oh, I do so hope he's having a pleasant journey, Zilla said in a strange, almost childish voice.
He spat into his hands and smoothed the tawny pelt over each forearm in turn, stretching each hand as he did so, so that the claws emerged. Gleaming black curves the size of a human's small finger, glinting in the soft sunlight like polished obsidian blades. The culture drone and the Homomdan male exchanged looks. Kabe lowered his head.
Chapter 6. Resistance is character forming.
Quillen wondered about their ship names. Perhaps it was some elaborate joke to send him on the final leg of his journey aboard a one-time warship, a gangster-class rapid offensive unit which had been demilitarized to become a very fast picket called Resistance is Character Forming. It was a jokey name, yet pointed. So many of their ship names were like that, even if more were just jokey. Chelgrian craft had romantic, purposeful, or poetic names, but the culture, while it had a sprinkling of ships with names of similar natures, usually went for ironic, meticulously obscure, supposedly humorous, or frankly absurd names. Perhaps this was partly because they had so many craft. Perhaps it reflected the fact that their ships were their own masters and chose their own names. The first thing he did when he stepped aboard the ship into a small foyer floored with gleaming wood and edged with blue-green foliage was to take a deep breath. "It smells like," he began.
"Home," said the voice in his head.
"Yes," Quillen breathed, and experienced a strange, weakening, pleasantly sad sensation, and suddenly thought of childhood.
"Careful, son."
"Major Quillen, welcome aboard," the ship said, from nowhere in particular. "I have introduced a fragrance into the air which should be reminiscent of the atmosphere around Lake Aitir, Chell, during springtime. Do you find this agreeable?"
Quillen nodded.
"Yes, yes, I do."
"Good.
Your quarters are directly ahead. Please make yourself at home." He'd been expecting a cabin as cramped as the one he'd been given on the nuisance value, but was pleasantly surprised. The Resistance's character forming's interior had been refitted to provide comfortable accommodation for about half a dozen people, rather than cramped quarters for four times that number. The ship was uncrewed, and chose not to use an avatar or drone to communicate. It just spoke to Quillen out of thin air, and carried out mundane housekeeping duties by creating internal maniple fields, so that clothes, for example, just floated around, seeming to clean and fold and sort and store themselves.
"It's like living in a fucking haunted house," Hyla said.
"Good job neither of us is superstitious."
"And it means it's listening to you, all the time. Spying."
"That could be interpreted as a form of honesty.
Or arrogance.
These things don't choose their names out of a hat."
"Resistance is character forming." If nothing else, as a motto, it was a little insensitive, given the circumstances of the war. Were they trying to tell him, and through him Chell itself, that they didn't really care about what had happened, despite all their protestations? Or even that they did care, and were sorry, yet it had all been for their own good? More likely, the ship's name was a coincidence. There was a sort of carelessness about the culture sometimes, A reverse side to the coin of the society's fabled thoroughness and tenacity of purpose, as though every now and again they caught themselves being overly obsessive and precise and tried to compensate by suddenly doing something frivolous or irresponsible. Or might they not get bored being good? Supposedly, they were infinitely patient, boundlessly resourceful, unceasingly understanding, but would not any rational mind, with or without the capital letter, grow tired of such unleavened niceness eventually? Wouldn't they want to cause just a little havoc, just once in a while, just to show what they could do? Or did such thoughts merely betray his own inheritance of animal ferocity? Chelgrians were proud of having evolved from predators. It was a kind of double pride, too, even if a few people regarded it as contradictory in nature. They were proud that their distant ancestors had been predators, but they were also proud that their species had evolved and matured away from the kind of behavior that inheritance might imply. Maybe only a creature with that ancient inheritance of savagery would think the way he, in his mind, had accused the minds of thinking. Maybe the humans, who could not claim quite such a purity of predatoriness in their past as Chelgrians, but who had certainly behaved savagely enough towards those of their own species and others since they began to become civilized, would also think that way, but their machines didn't. Perhaps that was even why they had handed over so much of the running of their civilization to the machines in the first place. They didn't trust themselves with the colossal powers and energies their science and technology had provided them with. Which might be comforting, but for one fact that many people found worrying, and, he suspected, the culture found embarrassing. Most civilizations that had acquired the means to build genuine artificial intelligences duly built them, and most of those designed or shaped the consciousness of the AIs to a greater or lesser extent. Obviously, if you were constructing a sentience that was or could easily become much greater than your own, it would not be in your interest to create a being which loathed you, and might be likely to set about dreaming up ways to exterminate you. So AIs, especially at first, tended to reflect the civilizational demeanor of their source species. Even when they underwent their own form of evolution and began to design their successors, with or without the help and sometimes the knowledge of their creators, there was usually still a detectable flavor of the intellectual character and the basic morality of that precursor species present in the resulting consciousness. That flavor might gradually disappear over subsequent generations of AIs, but it would usually be replaced by another, adopted and adapted from elsewhere, or just mutate beyond recognition rather than disappear altogether. What various involveds, including the culture, had also tried to do, often out of sheer curiosity, once AI had become a settled and even routine technology, was to devise a consciousness with no flavor. One with no metallogical baggage whatsoever. What had become known as a perfect AI. It turned out that creating such intelligences was not particularly challenging once you could build AIs in the first place. The difficulties only arose when such machines became sufficiently empowered to do whatever they wanted to do. They didn't go berserk and try to kill all about them, and they didn't relapse into some blissed-out state of machine solipsism. What they did do, at the first available opportunity, was sublime. Leaving the material universe altogether and joining the many beings, communities, and entire civilizations which had gone that way before. It was certainly a rule, and appeared to be a law, that perfect AIs always sublime. Most other civilizations thought this perplexing, or claimed to find it only natural, or dismissed it as mildly interesting, and sufficient to prove that there was little point in wasting time and resources creating such flawless but useless sentience. The culture, more or less alone, seemed to find the phenomenon almost a personal insult, if you could designate an entire civilization as a person. So a trace of some sort of bias, some element of moral or other partiality, must be present in the culture's minds. Why should that trace not be what would, in a human or a Chelgrin, be a perfectly natural predisposition towards boredom, caused by the sheer grinding relentlessness of their celebrated altruism, and a weakness for the occasional misdemeanor? A dark, wild weed of spite in the endless, suffing, golden fields of their charity. The thought did not disturb him, which itself seemed odd. Some part of him, some part that was hidden, dormant, even found the idea, if not pleasant, at least satisfactory, even useful. He increasingly had the feeling that there was more to discover about the mission he had undertaken, and that it was important, and that he would be all the more determined to do whatever it was that had to be done. He knew that he would know more about it later, remember more later, because he was remembering more now, all the time.
"And how are we today, Quill?"
Colonel Jaradimirge lowered himself into the seat by Quillan's bed. The colonel had lost his midlimb and one arm in a flyer crash on the very last day of the war. These were regrowing. Some of the casualties in the hospital seemed unconcerned about wandering around with developing limbs exposed, and some, often the more grizzled and proudly scarred ones, even made a joke of the fact that they had what looked exactly like a child's arm or midlimb or leg attached to themselves. Colonel Demirge preferred to keep his rematuring limbs covered up, which, to the extent that he really cared about anything, Quillan found more tasteful. The colonel seemed to have made it his duty to talk to all the patients in the hospital on a rota. Obviously it was his turn. He looked different today, Quillan thought. He seemed energized. Perhaps he was due to go home soon, or had been promoted.
"I'm fine, Jarrah."
"Aha! How's your new self coming along, anyway?"
"They seem happy enough.
Apparently I'm making satisfactory progress." They were in the military hospital at Lappendal, on Chell. Quillan was still confined to bed, though the bed itself was wheeled, powered, and self-contained, and could, had he wanted, have taken him throughout most of the hospital and a fair part of the grounds. Quillan thought this sounded like a formula for chaos, but allegedly the medical staff actually encouraged their charges to wander. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered. Quillan hadn't used the bed's mobility at all. He left it where it was, just to the side of the tall window which, he was told, looked out across the gardens and the lake to the forests on the far shore. He hadn't looked out of the window. He hadn't read anything, except for the screen when they tested his eyesight. He hadn't watched anything, except for the comings and goings of the medical staff, patients, and visitors in the corridor outside. Sometimes, when the door was left closed, he only heard the people in the corridor. Mostly he just stared ahead, at the wall on the far side of the room, which was white.
"That's good, yes," the colonel said. "When do they think you'll be out of that bed?"
"They think perhaps another 5 days." His injuries had been severe. One more day in the half-wrecked truck, struggling across the Phelan plains on Aorm, and he would have died. As it was, he had been delivered to Gulf City, triaged, and transferred to an invisible depot ship with only hours to spare. The depot vessel's hopelessly overstretched medics did their best to stabilize him. Still, he nearly died several more times. The loyalist military and his family negotiated his ransom. A neutral medical shuttlecraft from one of the caring orders took him to a Navy hospital ship. He was barely alive when he arrived. They had to throw away his body from the midriff down. Necrosis had eaten as far as his midlimb and was busily destroying his internal organs. In the end, they disposed of those too and amputated his midlimb, putting him on a total life support machine until the rest of his body regrew, part by part. Skeleton, organs, muscles and ligaments, skin and fur. The process was almost complete, though he had recovered more slowly than they'd expected. He could not believe that he had come so close to dying so many times, and had been so unlucky not to. Perhaps the thought of seeing Warasai, of surprising her, of seeing the expression on her face that he had daydreamed about in the crippled truck lurching across the plains, perhaps that had kept him going. He didn't know, because all he could remember after the first few days in the truck was in the form of momentary and disconnected sensations. Pain, a smell, a flash of light, a sudden feeling of nausea, an overheard word or phrase. So he did not know what his thoughts, assuming he'd had any thoughts, had been during that fevered, scrambled time. But it seemed to him perfectly possible and even likely that only those daydreams of Warasai had sustained him and made exactly the difference between his death and his survival. How cruel that thought was. To have been so close to a death he would now happily welcome, but prevented from embracing it by the misguided belief that he could ever see her alive again. He had only been told that she was dead after he'd arrived here in Lappendal. He'd been asking about her since he woke up from the first major operation on the Navy hospital ship, when they had reduced him to his head and upper trunk. He had brushed aside the doctor's solemn, careful explanation of how radical they had had to be and how much of his body they had had to sacrifice in order to save his life, and he had demanded, through his confusion and nausea and pain, to know where she was. The doctor hadn't known. He'd said he would find out, but then never reappeared in person, and nobody else on the staff seemed to be able to find out either. A chaplain from a caring order had done his best to determine the whereabouts of the Winter Storm and Warasai, but the war was still being waged, and discovering the location of a fighting ship, or anybody who might be on it, was not the sort of information you really expected to be told. He wondered who had known then that the ship was missing, presumed lost. Only the Navy, probably. It was likely that not even their own clan had been informed before it became obvious. Had there been a time when he could have been told of Warasai's fate and still have been close enough to death to have stepped easily over that threshold? Perhaps. Perhaps not. He'd finally been told by his brother-in-law, Warasai's twin, the day after the clan had been told. The ship was lost. Presumed destroyed. It and its single escort craft had been surprised by an invisible fleet a few days out of Aeom. The enemy attacked with what sounded like a sort of gravity wave impactor weapon. The larger ship was hit first. The escort vessel reported that the winter storm suffered total internal destruction, almost instantaneously. There had been no trace of any souls being saved from it. The escort craft tried to escape, was pursued, and run down. Its own destruction terminated its last message before it could even give its position. A few souls had been saved from it. Much later, they confirmed the details of the engagement. Warasai had died instantly, which Quillen supposed he ought to treat as some sort of blessing. But the calamity that had overtaken the winter storm had happened so quickly that there had been no time for the people aboard to be saved by their soul keepers, and the weaponry used against them had been specifically configured to destroy the devices themselves. It would be half a year before Quillen was able to appreciate the irony that in tuning the attack to wreck soul keeper scale technology, The impactor had left the old tech substrate, rescued from Aeorm, almost unharmed. Warasai's twin had broken down and cried when he'd told Quillen the news. Quillen felt a kind of distant concern for his brother-in-law and made some of the noises of comforting, but he did not cry, and trying to look into his own thoughts and feelings, all he could make out was a terrible barrenness, an almost complete lack of emotion, save for a feeling of puzzlement that he should experience so limited a reaction in the first place. He suspected his brother-in-law felt ashamed of crying in front of Quillen, or was offended that Quillen did not show any sign of sorrow. In any event, he only ever came for that one visit. Others of Quillen's own clan made the journey to see him, his father and various other relations. He found it difficult to know what to say to them. Their visits tailed off, and he was quietly relieved. A grief counsellor was assigned to him, but he didn't know what to say to her either, and felt he was letting her down, not being able to follow her leads into emotional areas she said she thought he needed to explore. Chaplains were no more comfort. When the war ended, suddenly, unexpectedly, just a few days earlier, he'd thought something like, "Well, I'm glad that's over." But he realized almost immediately that he hadn't really felt anything. The rest of the patients and the staff of the hospital wept and laughed and grinned, and those who could got drunk and parted into the night. But he felt oddly dissociated from it all, and experienced only resigned annoyance at the noise, which kept him awake after he'd normally have been safely asleep. Now his only regular visitor, save for the medical staff, was the colonel. "Don't suppose you've heard, have you?" Colonel Demirge said. His eyes seemed to shine, and he looked, Quillen thought, like somebody who has just escaped death, or won an unlikely bet.
"Heard what, Jarrah?"
"About the war, Major. About how it started, who caused it, why it ended so suddenly."
"No, I haven't heard anything about that."
"Didn't you think it stopped hell of a quick?"
"I didn't really think about it. I suppose I rather lost touch with things while I was unwell. I didn't appreciate how quickly the war ended."
"Well, now we know the reason why," the colonel said, and slapped the side of Quillen's bed with his good arm. "It was those bastard culture people."
"They stopped the war?"
Chell had had contact with the culture for the last few hundred years. They were known to be widespread throughout the galaxy, and technologically superior, though without the Chelgrians' apparently unique link with the sublimed, and prone to allegedly altruistic interference. One of the more forlorn hopes people had cleaved to during the war was that the culture would suddenly step in and gently prize the combatants apart, making everything all right again. It hadn't happened. Neither had the Chelgrian Puen, Chell's own advanced force amongst the sublimed, stepped in, which had been an even more pious hope. What had happened, more prosaically but scarcely less surprisingly, was that the two sides in the war, the Loyalists and the Invisibles, had suddenly started talking, and with surprising speed, come to an agreement. It was a compromise that didn't really suit anybody, but certainly it was better than a war that was threatening to tear Chelgrian civilization apart. Was Colonel Demiurge saying that the culture somehow had intervened?
"Oh, they stopped it, if you want to look at it that way." The colonel leant close over Quillen.
"You want to know how?"
Quillen did not particularly care, but it would be rude to say so.
"How?"
"They told us, and the Invisibles, the truth. They showed us who the real enemy was."
"Oh, so they did intervene after all." Quillen was still confused.
"Who is the real enemy?"
"Them. The culture, that's who," the colonel said, slapping Quillen's bedside again.
He sat back, nodding, his eyes bright. They stopped the war by confessing that they started it in the first place. That's what they did.
I don't understand.
The war had begun when the newly enfranchised and empowered Invisibles had turned all their recently acquired weaponry on those who had been their betters in the old enforced caste system. New militias and equalitarian guard companies had been created as a result of the abortive guards' revolt, when part of the army had tried to stage a coup after the first equalitarian election. The militias and the companies, and the accelerated training up of the one-time lower castes, so that they could take command of a majority of the Navy's ships, were part of an attempt to democratize Chell's armed forces and ensure that through a system of power balances, no single branch of the armed forces could take control of the state. It was an imperfect and expensive solution, and it meant that more people than ever before had access to vastly powerful weaponry. But all that had to happen for it to work was that nobody behaved insanely. But then Muonze, the spade caste president, had seemed to do just that, and been joined by half of those who had gained most through the reforms. How could the culture have had anything to do with that? Quillen suspected the colonel was determined to tell him. It was the culture that got that equalitarian idiot Kapiri elected president before Muonze, Dimirge said, leaning over Quillen again. Their fingers were on the scales all the time. They were promising the parliamentarians the whole fucking galaxy if they voted for Kapiri. Ships, habitats, technologies, the gods only know what. So in comes Kapiri, out goes common sense. Out goes 3,000 years of tradition. Out goes the system. In comes their precious fucking equality and that ballless cretin Muonze. And you know what?
No, what?
They got him elected, too. Same tactics. Basic bribery.
Oh.
And what are they saying now?
Quillen shook his head.
They're saying they didn't know he was going to go crazy. That it never occurred to them that a bit of equality, exactly what these people had been shouting for all this time, might not be enough for them. That some of them might just be stupid and vicious enough to want revenge. Never dawned on them that their shit-caste friends might want to do some score-settling. No, that wouldn't make sense. That wouldn't be logical.
The colonel almost spat that last word.
So, when it all blew up in our faces, they were still moving their own ships and military people away from us. Didn't have the forces to intervene. Couldn't find 9/10 of the people they'd been paying off and whispering to because they were dead, like Muonze, or being held hostage or in hiding.
The colonel sat back again.
So, our civil war wasn't really one at all. It was all these do-gooders' work. Frankly, I don't know that even this is the truth. How do we really know they're as powerful and advanced as they claim? Maybe their science is little better than ours, and they were getting frightened of us. Maybe they meant all this to happen.
Quillen was still trying to take all this in. After a few moments, while the colonel sat there nodding, he said, "Well, if they had, they wouldn't suddenly admit it, would they?"
"Ha! Maybe it was about to come out anyway. So they tried to look as good as they could by confessing."
"But if they told both us and the Invisibles in the first place to stop the war,
same thing. Maybe we were about to find out on our own. They were just making the best of a bad job. I mean," Demirge said, tapping one claw on the side of Quillen's bed, "can you believe they've actually had the gall to quote figures, statistics at us? Telling us that this hardly ever happens. That 99% or whatever of these interferences go according to plan. That we've just been really unlucky.
and they're really sorry, and they'll help us rebuild."
The colonel shook his head.
"The nerve of them! If we hadn't lost most of our best in that insane fucking war that they caused, I'd be tempted to go to war with them."
Quillan stared at the other male. The colonel's eyes were wide. His head fur was standing straight as he shook his head. He found that his own head was shaking too, in disbelief. "Is all this true?" he asked. "Really?" The colonel stood up, as though impelled by his anger. "You should watch the news, Quill." He looked around, as though for something to take his rage out on, then took a deep breath. "Won't be the end of this, I tell you, Major. Not the end. Not by a long, long way." He nodded. "I'll see you later, Quill. Goodbye for now." He slammed the door on his way out. And so Quillan did switch on a screen, for the first time in months, and discovered that it was indeed all very much as the colonel had said, and that the pace of change in his own society had truly been forced by the culture, and it, by its own confession, had offered what they called help, and others might have called bribes, to get elected the people it thought ought to be elected, and advised and cajoled and wheedled and arguably threatened its way to what it thought was best for the Chelgrians. It had started to slacken off its involvement and stand down the forces it had secretly brought up to near the Chelgrian sphere of influence and colonization in case things went wrong, when, without any warning, it had all gone quite spectacularly wrong. Their excuses were as the colonel had laid out, though there was also, Quillan thought, a hint that they weren't as used to predator-evolved species as they were to others, and that had been a factor in their failure to anticipate either the catastrophic behaviour change which started with Mwanze and cascaded down through the restructured society, or the suddenness and ferocity with which it occurred once it had begun. He could hardly believe it, but he had to. He watched a lot of screen. He talked to the colonel and to some other patients who'd started to come to visit him. It was all true. All of it. One day, the day before he was to be allowed out of his bed for the first time, he heard a bird singing in the grounds outside his window. He clicked at the buttons on the bed's control panel and made it turn and raise him up so that he could look out of the window. The bird must have flown off, but he saw the cloud-scattered sky, the trees on the far side of the glittering lake, the breaking waves on the rocky shore, and the wind-stroked grasses of the hospital grounds. Once, in a market in Rabundi, he had bought her a caged bird because it sang so beautifully. He took it to the room they were hiring while she completed her thesis paper on temple acoustics. She thanked him graciously, walked to the window, opened the cage's door, and shooed the little bird out. It flew away over the square, singing. She watched the bird for a moment until it disappeared, then looked round to him with an expression that was at once apologetic, defiant, and concerned. He was leaning against the doorframe, smiling at her. His tears dissolved the view. Chapter 7. Peer Group. Important visitors to Massac were usually transshipped by a giant ceremonial barge of gilded wood, glorious flags, and generally fabulous aspect, encased within an ellipsoid envelope of perfumed air, sewn with 500,000 perfumed candle balloons. For the Chelgrian emissary Quillan, Hub thought that such flagrant ostentation might strike a discordant, overly celebratory note. And so instead, a plain but stylish personnel module was sent to rendezvous with the ex-warship Resistance's character forming.
The welcoming party consisted of one of the Hub's thin, silver-skinned avatars, the drone, E.H. Tersono, the Homomdan Kabe Ishloye, and a human female representative from the orbital's general board called Estre Lassils, who both looked and was old. She had long white hair, currently gathered into a bun, and a very tanned, deeply lined face. And for all her age, she was tall and slim, and carried herself very upright. She wore a formal-looking plain black dress with a single brooch. Her eyes were bright, and Kabe formed the impression that a lot of the grooves on her face were smile and laughter lines. He immediately liked her, and given that the general board had been elected by the human and drone population of the orbital, and itself had duly chosen her to represent it, decided that so must everybody else. "Hub," Estre Lassils said, in an amused-sounding voice, "your skin looks more matte than usual." The orbital's avatar wore white trousers and a tight jacket over its silvery skin, which did indeed, Kabe thought, seem less reflective than it usually appeared. The creature nodded. "There are Chelgrian source tribes which once had superstitious beliefs concerning mirrors," it said in its incongruously deep voice. Its wide black eyes blinked. Estre Lassils found herself looking at a pair of tiny images of herself, depicted in the avatar's eyelids, which it had briefly turned fully reflective. "I thought, just to be on the safe side."
"I see. And how is everybody on the board, Ms. Lassils?"
the drone Tersono asked. It appeared, if anything, more reflective than usual, its rosy porcelain skin and lacy lumenstone frame looking highly polished. The woman shrugged.
"As ever, I haven't seen them for a couple of months. The next meeting's..."
She looked thoughtful. "In 10 days' time," supplied her brooch. "Thank you, House," she said. She nodded at the drone. "There you are." The general board was supposed to represent the inhabitants of the orbital to Hub at the highest level. It was pretty much an honorary office, given that each individual could talk directly to Hub whenever they wanted. But as that carried even the most thinly theoretical possibility that a mischievous or deranged Hub could play every single person on an orbital off against each, to further some unspecified nefarious scheme, it was usually thought sensible to have a conventionally elected and delegated setup as well. It also meant that visitors from more autocratic or layered societies were provided with somebody they could identify as an official representative of the whole population. The main reason that Kabe decided he liked Estre Lassils was that despite being there in this arguably quite consequential ceremonial role, she did represent nearly 50 billion people, after all, she had, apparently on a whim, brought along one of her nieces, a 6-year-old child called Chomba. The girl was thin and blonde, and sat quietly on the padded edge of the central pool in the personnel module's circular main lounge area as it sped out to meet the still decelerating resistance's character forming. She wore a pair of deep purple shorts and a loose jacket of vivid yellow. Her feet were dangling in the water, where long red fish swam amongst artfully arranged rocks and beds of gravel. They eyed the child's waggling toes with leery curiosity and were gradually approaching. The others stood, or in Tersono's case floated, in a group in front of the lounge's forward screen section. The screen extended right round the circular wall of the lounge, so that when it was all activated, it looked as if you were riding through space standing on one large disc with another suspended over your head. The ceiling could act as a screen too, as could the floor, though some people found the full effect unsettling. The tallest, deepest part of the screen faced directly forwards, and it was there that Kabe glanced now and again. But all it showed was the star field, with a slowly flashing red ring, showing the direction the ship was approaching from. Two broad bands of Massac orbital traversed the screen from floor to ceiling. And there was a big storm system of whirled clouds visible on one mostly oceanic plate. But Kabe was more distracted by the sinuously swimming fish and the human child. It was one of the effects of living in a society where people commonly lived for 4 centuries, and on average bore just over 1 child each, that there were very few of their young around. And as these children tended to stick together in their own peer groups, rather than be found distributed throughout the society, there seemed to be even fewer than there really were. It was more or less accepted in some quarters that the culture's whole civilizational demeanor resulted from the fact that every single human in the society had been thoroughly, comprehensively, and imaginatively spoiled as a child by virtually everyone around them.
This ends side 1 of cassette 4.